My life story is very, I can say it's shaped by violence. I come from a family background of Southeast Asians, refugees. My mom, my father have fled war during the genocide. I was born in a Thailand refugee camp. My memories of living in a Thailand camp was very vague. Just remember feeling lots of fear, uncertainty, always needing my mother because she was always working at the rice fields, very feeling isolated. Shortly after I turned one, my biological father left my mother and I, he returned to Cambodia. So I stayed in the refugee camps for about 5 years. We were sponsored to the US and we relocated a year after from Jackson, Florida to San Diego, California. Shortly thereafter, that's when my mother met my stepfather, her boyfriend at that time. He became a source of instability. Domestic violence was rampant in the house. He was verbally, physically abusive, which for me as a kid affected me traumatically. And I mean, although I did went to school, got good grades, and the eldest of two half siblings, I unfortunately, as a teenager, found myself in a very abusive relationship by the time I was 17 years old. For me, not having the model relationship growing up, you know, with my mom and stepfather, the way he treated me was really similar to that of my stepfather, but I felt as long as he was not being abusive, putting hands on me, that I would be able to continue to remain in that relationship with him. And I was going to my senior year in high school. And shortly thereafter, he became jealous of my work supervisor at that time because I wanted, you know, I went outside of the relationship, and in his jealous rage, he forced me to confront my supervisor, which he ended up shooting and killing him. Because of the abuse and fear of him killing me, my family, I kept it quiet for 3 years, but ultimately I was able to break free from the relationship after connecting with my coworkers at that time who supported me, reached out to the police. I talked to them, but I didn't realize that because of me talking, I incriminated myself. They ended up arresting me, charging me with my abuser's behavior, and ultimately I was convicted of first-degree murder, sentenced to life without parole at 21 years old. Then I found myself at the Central Calvary Women's Facility, the world's largest women's prison. Felt very disconnected, lost, suicidal. Just felt hopelessness that I was never leaving prison. Fortunately, I was able to find connections with other women whose background was similar to mine, but yet they were also at the same time, first time being incarcerated. And I realized that majority of them were also survivors of trauma or sexual assaults, that they were not the main perpetrators, it was their abusers. And a few years later, the courts threw out my conviction and I was resentenced to 15 years to life, which gave me an opportunity to be granted parole. And then throughout my journey throughout prison, I was able to heal, to grow, facilitated many groups, you know, self-help group therapy for the years of trauma and domestic violence that I experienced, you know, from childhood up until, you know, my adult relationship. And as well, I was able to mentor other young women that found themselves incarcerated in a similar situation like mine. But I didn't realize that for me as a permanent refugee, you know, resident coming here to the US, that I was also facing deportation. So I seeked out through Advancing Justice Asia Law Caucus, and lo and behold, they told me that was true because of my legal status and of my permanent, of my conviction makes me deportable. But they believed that I should have never been incarcerated in the first place, and that they were willing to help fight for my freedom out of ICE detention. And I was found suitable for parole in 2016. And by the time 2017, unfortunately, on the day of my release in May, I was picked up by ICE, transferred to Yuba County ICE facility, where I spent 6 months fighting deportation. The 6 months that I was there, I was really grateful for the community support. Many organizations throughout California supported me, able to build relationships with some of the organizers like Survived and Punished, who I am now an organizer with. And I was granted relief from an immigration judge saying that I couldn't be deported to Cambodia for fears that if I did get deported there, that the government in Cambodia couldn't protect me from the threats of my co-defendant. because he, you know, I believe made through his promise that if I ever, because he blamed me for putting him in prison, that if I ever left prison, that he would come after me. So the judge believed me and granted me immunity not to be deported. However, they appealed it, but they lost. But eventually, at my 6-month mark, I was granted bond. The community were able to provide the funds for my release, you know, which I'm really grateful for. And shortly thereafter, paroled to the Bay Area in San Francisco. I worked with the Asian Law Caucus, did a lot of organizing work, work around survivors like myself, and supporting community members that are in ICE detention or imprisoned, or like Southeast Asian refugees that have been out in the community for a long time, but then they were arrested through their ICE check-ins, and their family reaching out to us like, you know, can you please help my husband or my uncle? They've been picked up by ICE. So I've been really grateful for working with the numerous, you know, freedom campaigns for folks that are seeking pardons, got pardons for them. I've been able to, in the work that I do, talk with legislators about the impact of Southeast Asian deportation, incarceration of immigrant survivors. I spoke at the Capitol, majority of the work in Capitol, at the Capitol here in California, spoke in front of Congress. And I was able to apply for a pardon in 2019. And about almost a year later, I was granted a full and conditional pardon by Governor Newsom. You know, although I am relieved because of that I don't have to fear ICE picking me up, you know, starting deportation proceedings, that I'm not deportable anymore. I want to be able to provide the same opportunity for many people like me, you know, immigrants and refugees that have served these lengthy amount of time, that are criminalized, you know, because of being immigrants, you know, the targeting. As we know, you know, mass incarceration affects, you know, Black communities and Asian communities, people of color. It's really rare for someone to be doing that work that has been impacted, right, that have experienced it. So I knew that if I could able to use my background, my own experience with prisons and with, you know, detention, facing deportation, that it was a way to let people know that, you know, it's okay that you can lean on us or lean on me for support, that I understand what you're going through. And that is that, who would have thought 5 years even before I went to Cold War that I was going to be doing the work that, you know, that I'm doing, that the trajectory of my life is that I want to remain in the social movement world, right? Whether it be immigrant rights, criminal justice reform, that this is my calling. I don't see myself doing anything else, like working retail or being a fitness instructor. No, I mean, this is like my life's work. I did have times when I was in ICE detention that I felt skeptical that, what if I get deported? Like, what do I do, you know, in life in Cambodia? I've never been in Cambodia. You know, I was one of the Thailand refugee camp. I think what kept me going was thinking, you know, being optimistic, knowing that I had people that cared for me, that loved me, that believed me, that if they weren't going to give up on me, so why should I just, you know, give up on myself? You know, I'm a Cambodian woman. I'm a, you know, of a child of a genocide survivor, a domestic violence survivor. I'm someone's sister, eldest sister, a community leader, an organizer. Yeah, I mean, I'm a friend. I'm definitely not anybody's foe or enemy. No, that's who I am. How do you approach someone that has harmed, right? The survivor, the victims, someone that has physically, we're talking about hurting another individual. I mean, that in itself, I can imagine it's unforgiving, right? Especially for the victims, when they or myself think about our abusers. We want them far removed as possible from us physically, emotionally, not to think about them. But I think it took me a long time to come to this understanding that in order to, for us as survivors, as victims to heal, we have to not only, we have to hold the perpetrator or the abuser accountable, but also holding them accountable is to say that, to recognize they are victims themselves. One way or another, they were victims of trauma. My understanding is that people that hurt people, majority of them are survivors themselves, whether they were at a young age, as a child, abuse, of molestation. We have to get down to the root, like where did their hurt and anger came from, right? And when that is unresolved or unmet or undealt with, if they weren't able to get that support, that counseling, that whoever hurt them to deal with that, unfortunately they grow up and they enact the same type of behaviors or abuse that their abuser did to them. And I say that, which is really true, because from my years of doing restorative justice programs, from my own therapy, it is, they've done tons of research that majority of people who are incarcerated or have harmed others, it's because they were themselves victims of, again, abuse, many types of trauma. And learning that, I realized that I thought about like my co-defender, my abuser himself, and it made a lot of sense learning about him throughout my trial process that he was also a abused at a young age, where he tried to take his life as a teenager. He drank chemicals his mother had shared. He, at that time, was a child of that time growing up during the war before then. So I can imagine a lot of intergenerational trauma. We got to recognize that everybody is capable of change, of being able to understand and work and to forgive, to know that someone forgive them or want them to be not incarcerated or not die in prison. It's really, it sounds really radical, but it's not. I think if we put that into practice, right, alternative ways to hold them accountable, whether it be putting them one-on-one, you know, through counseling, through therapy, a conversation, a mediating conversation, a dialogue, I think between the person that's being harmed and the person that has done harm. Yeah, and then for myself, if I was to ever come across my abuser, right, I think I would not like say, hey, we need to really talk about it. I think acknowledge his presence and say, you know, I'm glad you're out. Just want you to know whatever hurt that I've done to you or whatever hurt that you've done to me, that I'm forgiving you. And I, you know, really wish the best for you moving forward for you, your family. And I don't want to do any harm for you. Yeah, I think that's my approach when it comes to people that have done harm and also for my abuser.